the idea for this talk really comes from an idea that came from Fiona Jeffries and Padmini Biswas and some of the other people who hang out around the Center for Place, Culture and Politics. And Fiona said to me one day, it would be very helpful to if some of you who've been around a while and fussed about things, if you talked a little bit about the methodological foundations of what you do and how those methodological foundations help you understand what's going on in the world around you. So I actually decided to take that challenge up and state straight out that the methodological foundations are not foundations in the ordinary sense of the word. They're really shifting sands all of the time. They're changing. But if I look back, I would say they've been changing in large part through a process of dialogue between what I'm doing and what I'm interested in and what Karl Marx thought about things. And I say Marx rather than Marxist because although I read a lot of the Marxists in the early days, I less and less did I find myself reading that and more sort of fussing with how Marx was formulating things. And in particular, I suppose that arose out of the fact that I was teaching Marx's Capital pretty much every year, and it was always sort of changing. My interpretations were changing. So I thought I'd give you a little bit of an idea here of how that dialogue, where it stands right now, which is not necessarily where it stood 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and I really have no clear idea exactly about the evolutionary process, but I know it's happened. And there are four themes I want to look at, and each one could take about an hour, so I'm going to try and compress the themes very briefly into about 15-minute segments and hope I can manage to do that. And the first theme arises out of my interpretation of some statements in the Grundrisse, and I'll read it to you, and probably it'll sound pretty much gibberish, but then I'll explain what I think is going on here. Marx, in the introduction to the Critique of Political Economy, which is also the introduction to the Grundrisse, does a review of classical political economy and how he sees classical political economic thought being structured. And he says this. He says, production, distribution, exchange, and consumption form a regular syllogism. Production is the generality, distribution and exchange the particularity, and consumption the singularity in which the whole is joined together. This is admittedly a coherence, but a shallow one. Production is determined by general natural laws, distribution by social accident, exchange stands between them as a formal social movement between individuals, and the concluding act of consumption, which is conceived not only as a terminal point, but also as an end in itself, actually belongs outside of economics, except insofar as it reacts back upon production. What Marx then does is to go through a long discussion of what's the relationship between production and exchange and distribution and exchange, and, you know, it's a very convoluted kind of argument, as often happens with Marx. But he then reaches a conclusion. The conclusion is this. The conclusion we reach is not that production, distribution, exchange, and consumption are identical, as Hegelians would do, but that they all form members of a totality, distinctions within a unity. Production not only predominates over itself in the antithetical definition of production, but over the other moments as well. A definite production thus determines a definite consumption, distribution, and exchange, as well as definite relations between these different moments. Admittedly, however, in its one-sided form, production is itself determined by the other moments. Mutual interaction takes place between the different moments. This is the case with every organic whole. Now, what this does is to set up a number of categories, and I want to roughly just run through them and lay them out and think about them for a moment. We have production. We have distribution. We have exchange. And we have consumption. And Marx sees these as, in classical political economy, this is not his view, in classical political economy he sees these being arranged in a kind of a weak syllogism. That is, production is the driving force, these are the mediating elements, and this is the final destination, as it were. So he says, this is the generality. These two are the particularities. And this is the singularity. This is also general law, or as he calls it, natural law. This is a matter of, say, conjunctural or accidental. And this is chaotic or unpredictable. What Marx does is to offer some amendments to this schema, which comes from classical political economy. And the amendments look like this. Firstly, he criticizes classical political economy for seeing capitalism as natural. As comes out of social Darwinism, competition is natural, everything is natural, blah, blah, blah. And in the theory, it was therefore thought that production could not, under any circumstances, be really changed because it was a fact of nature. It was outside of us. All that we could do was really deal with distribution and with consumption. So what Marx does is to offer another element. That is, the generality is displaced by suggesting that there is a universality, which is about nature, if you like, outside of us, natural processes within which we are embedded. But he also sees capital accumulation as law-like and therefore general. And in the same way you can establish natural laws, you can establish social laws of a capitalist mode of production. So the universality refers, if you go to capital, to the relationship between human beings and nature, the metabolic relation between humanity and nature. And in capital he uses that language, this is a universal condition of human existence no matter what the mode of production. On the other hand, the generality here is law-like, and therefore we have to establish what the laws are of capitalistic production. And those laws can be established independent of the particularities and the singularities to some degree. Now, what Marx does in Capital, and as I often emphasize in the Capital class, is what Marx does is actually attempt to create an alternative political economy. He's not trying to create a theory of the world. I mean, everybody kind of pretends he does, and then they dismiss him. You know, he's not. He's trying to create an alternative political economy. And in this alternative of political economy, first of all, the distinction between universality and generality is introduced. But secondly, we dismiss the syllogistic form and we say all of this is part of a totality. And it is all, the moments are all in interaction with each other. But the moments have different qualities in terms of what we can or cannot say about them. Whereas when it comes to the generality, we can start talking about the laws of motion of capitalism, the laws of motion of accumulation. And we can talk about it in those terms. When it comes to the particularities, we have to talk about all sorts of things which are going on in terms of the conjunctural forces, the state of class struggle, social struggle, all the rest of it. We have to do all of that. And when it comes to singularities, of course, we're dealing with the sort of roiling world of human passions and desires and wants and needs and all of that. It is a singularity. And those of you who've read your Hart and Negri and your Spinoza will know what's all meant by that, okay? Which means it is out of actual clear determination. Now, what Marx does with singularities in Capital is to dismiss them as he can't deal with them, and therefore they lie outside of economy. So on the first page of Capital, he says, okay, wants, needs, desires, all of those things, to study those is the work of history. It's not the work of political economy. So therefore, I don't consider those very much in what follows in Capital. Furthermore, what you find in the structure of Capital is a reluctance to deal at all with the particularities of distribution or exchange. Consider, for example, but here you hit a problem. Because wage labor is a part of production, and it's fundamental to understanding the general laws of capital accumulation. The wage level, however, is a fact of distribution. And if you go to Capital, look how he deals with the wage level as opposed to wage labor as a category. The wage level, the value of labor power, is dealt with in two pages, in which he says all of these things are going on, class struggle, history, culture, blah, 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 but, you know, at a given point in history, we know what the wage level is and we can assume it's fixed. He does the same with almost everything else that he hits in the realm of distribution. We hit, for example, in the realm of distribution, questions of credit, interest. Dismiss it, put it aside. Again and again and again, right throughout Capital until the end of Volume 3, you do not consider the world of distribution, the world of particularity. What you try to do is to work at the level of generality. And that is what he's doing. But the world of generality is not all there is, clearly. So when Marx moves to his historical works, what he does is he goes, as it were, treating this totality. So when you're reading the 18th Brumaire, you'll find all of these elements start to come into play, the singularities, the collective singularities of different class formations. How is it that the singularity of Louis Bonaparte came to power in the way it did? You can't understand that simply by appeal to that world of generality. On the other hand, you can't understand it either without understanding that generality and how that generality is working. So this is how he actually sets up his argument. And what you see in this is that the distinction between the historical works and the thematic of Capital, which is about the world of generality, is very important to acknowledge. Now, in my own work, what you find is that I'm spent a lot of my time working on the level of generality. That's what The Limits to Capital was about. That's what much of the theorizing I do is about. On the other hand, when I get to something like the Second Empire Paris, then obviously I have to move in some other direction. But there are different explanatory frameworks that come into this. Obviously, the general laws which go on up there can be established by a particular research methodology, if you like. The distribution and exchange cannot be analyzed without going into the world of particularities. Now, Marx at various times said, okay, I want to deal with the particularities of exchange and the particularities of distribution. For example, one of the key elements of exchange is competition. And about four times in Capital, at key points in Capital, Marx says, the coercive laws of competition here come into the picture and I can't do without them. But he then says, but I can't deal with them further here. The whole world of exchange, in other words, cannot be taken out of that law-like character up there any more than the facts of distribution can. So the issue then arises within the totality, how do we establish relations? I would suggest that the general law of capital accumulation can be established in kind of law-like manner. Now, the particularities are about the research of history and the state of class struggle, for example, becomes absolutely crucial, or the state of competition, or the legal framework that fixes exchange, all of those sorts of things come into that point, and therefore you're dealing with the specificities of a particular society in a particular time. And when you get into the world of singularities, you're dealing with human behaviors, which can run all over the place, and you can have psychoanalytic explanations and, you know, and all the rest of it. Now, in the book I just finished, which has just now been published in Britain, called The Enigma of Capital, I started out, in a way, asking the simple question, what could I say about this crisis that other people were not saying? And I looked, you look at all of this and you say, well, actually, a lot of the explanations of this crisis exist in the world of singularity. You know, Alan Greenspan, when asked what went wrong, said, well, it's human greed, and you can't do anything about human greed. You know? Other people talk about infectious greed. They talk about the animal spirits of the entrepreneur. They start talking about the psychoanalysis of psychoanalytic understanding of that desire for mastery of the universe. And you get these books called The Masters of the Universe and so on. And so you have a whole slew of books coming out right now which explain this crisis solely almost in terms of the fact the system went wrong because human passions are such that they just got out of control and greed and blah, blah, blah. Okay? Now, that's not wrong. Indeed, there's a lot of that around. I mean, you can't read all the stories coming out about, you know, what's going on Wall Street and say this is rubbish. It's not at all. It's very much there. But it's not the whole of the story. You then move to the second level and say another level of explanation is, well, this is all due to institutional failures, that the exchange relation broke down, the coercive laws of competition got lost, there was monopoly, or there was, you know, institutional arrangements, or that the financiers became too powerful relative to everybody else. So you get a whole kind of set of explanations of the crisis which actually exist at this realm of singularity. And then there are others, you know, particularly the environmentalists, who start to say, well, it actually exists in the realm of universality. You know, we're at peak oil or something like that, and so that is really, that's behind it all, and so on. But the one thing it seemed to me was missing was an explanation of the crisis in terms of the generality. And I know the generality, and I don't see many accounts of the crisis in relationship to the generality. So I decided I would try to write a book about how to understand this crisis against the background of the generality without denying what's going on in the singularities and what's going on in the particularities, but trying to show that what's going on there is connected in some way with the laws of motion of a capitalist system, which is inherently contradictory and therefore always produces crises and crises of certain sort. Now, in this formulation I put forward, Marx says something interesting which I think I should come back to. What he says is that production is at the center. Now, I think for several years I probably misread that as meaning material production is involved here. And then one day, this is the kind of thing that comes to you. One day you're reading through Capital and you kind of say, you know, Marx doesn't really say material production, you know, determines anything. What kind of production is going on here, which is determinate? And, of course, it's the production of surplus value. What makes capital capital is circulation and finding a profit, i.e. producing and harvesting surplus value. And it is the production of surplus value that lies at the center of this. And when Marx kind of says everything else that goes on is contingent to that, he's not saying as if some material production is forcing sociality. He says a form of sociality about the production of surplus value is central to this system, and therefore human greed will focus on appropriating and creating the surplus value and how the surplus value is used and all the rest of it. That is what it will focus upon. So that the production of surplus value then moves central into the question. That's part one. Part two, all right. How is surplus value produced? Well, there are various ways in which it can be captured and so on, but the basic system he sets up is this. That money is used to buy labor power and means of production And with a given technology and organizational form, you go into production, you come out with a commodity, and then you sell that commodity for the money plus an increment, which is a surplus value. Then, for reasons which we will touch upon a little bit, a part of that surplus value gets recapitalized. So the next time around, this bit means you need more labor power, more means of production, and the whole thing expands. So this is an expanding system. This is, if you like, is the framework within which Marx sets out how capital accumulation occurs. Now, in the Grundrisse, Marx also says there are limits and barriers in this process. And what I decided to do was to start to look at where the limits and barriers lie and use that notion of limits and barriers to say whenever a limit is encountered, capital has to transcend it or circumvent it. And if it doesn't transcend it or circumvent it, then it's blocked. And if it's blocked, then you've got a crisis. So at any one of these points, as it were, you can generate a crisis. So what are the various points? First point, where does the initial money come from? Now, it's interesting, in Capital, Marx doesn't want to deal with that other than saying it all came from primitive accumulation. But actually, the whole problem of getting enough money in the right place at the right time is a very serious one. And it's very surprising Marx didn't deal with it because Saint-Simon, who he was very familiar with, is always talking about associated capitals getting together, and Marx knew perfectly well that actually what was going on in Second Empire Paris was that new financial institutions were being constructed which assembled all of this capital and put it together to build the boulevards and all the rest of it. So the form in which the money is initially set up is itself a potential blockage point. And there are two ways, or three ways, it can be a blockage point. The first way is the financial institutions are inadequate, that they do not adjust to the situation. And it's very interesting if you go back in the literature, there's a lot of chatter in the bourgeois literature of the 1970s and 1980s about the problems of what is called financial repression, which was about the financial system is not adequate to the purpose. So what did Reagan do? He came in and said, okay, we've got to liberate it. We've got to deregulate it. And we've got to globalize it. And we get the Big Bang and we get, you know, unification of the New York and the London stock markets and in the end the kind of unification. So financial innovation becomes absolutely crucial. If without that financial innovation, you will get a blockage. And it could be said that there was a blockage in the system in the early 70s that had to be circumvented. And much of the financial innovation has gone on since has been about trying to relieve what was earlier seen as a blockage with the breakdown of Bretton Woods and all the rest of it in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The second way in which this can be a problem is you get excessive innovation. And excessive innovation means that the system goes haywire, it gets out of control. And there's a lot of evidence that the control structures within the financial system broke down. A shadow banking system grew up, which nobody was in control of, and it just sort of spiraled out of control. So here's the second way in which you can get a crisis. And in effect, while financial repression was a problem back in the 1960s, lack of financial repression is now actually part of the problem. Then there's a third way. And this comes about the fact that the people who assemble this just don't do it as a good deed. They do it because they want money. They do it for interest. Marx didn't want to handle interest because it was a fact of distribution, which is why he never brought all of this into Volume 1 of Capital, where it should be. He left it out. And, of course, as they get more money, they get power. Money is a form of social power appropriated by private persons. So you get the excessive power of the financiers. This becomes a subclass relation. What's the relation of power between the financiers and the producers? And when you start to look at the rate of profit in manufacturing and the rate of profit in finance, you know, 1990s, they cross. Finance went like this, and the rate of profit in manufacturing went down like that. Excessive power. And, you know, factions of capital, once they get a lot of power, don't give it up. And they sock it to other factions of capital unless you watch out. So here is, if you like, one potential blockage point, which has a lot to say about exactly what has gone on in this particular financial crisis. The second blockage point is labor power. Now, again, I don't want to go into this because I'm sure for all of you it's pretty evident that if labor is very powerful, it can actually put a block on the system. It can hold back capital accumulation by high wage rates or by, you know, denying productivity gains and things of that kind. Now, there's a lot of evidence at the end of the 1960s, early 1970s, that this was a primary barrier to capital accumulation. Capital was weak relative to labor. Labor had assembled a great deal of power within, by the way, a certain spatial configuration, within national state configurations. Within the nation state, social democratic forces could get and start to increase the social wage, and they started more and more money is going into social wage, and unions are being very strong, and they're pushing up the actual wage, and so, you know, so there's a real problem. Real problem in 1960s, 1970s. And capital had to find a way to deal with it. How did it do it? Well, immigration was one thing. And it's astonishing when you look from now and kind of look at what's going on, all the anti-immigration stuff, that the Germans were bringing in the Turks, the French were bringing in the Maghrebians, the British were drawing on their empire, the Swedes were bringing the Yugoslavs. The 1965 Reform Act, Immigration Reform Act in this country, gave this country access to global labor supplies. So immigration is one of them, and immigration continues, of course, to be one of the ways in which you discipline a labor force. The other way is you outsource. So you go to wherever the labor is. But in order to outsource, notice something. If you're going to outsource, you need a very, very sophisticated global financial system. In other words, the financial innovations, which were instituted in the 1970s and 1980s, had everything to do with facilitating the free flow of capital from one part of the world to another, so capital could get from here to there, and if labor costs were lower there, you could go to China, you could go to the maquila zones, or you could go somewhere else, wherever you wanted. So outsourcing. Technological change was another part. Labor-saving technological changes. Now, that process I told you about, suggested to you of nation-state, the global economy being sort of nation-states, with nation-states in charge of their own fiscal and monetary policies, also allowed monopoly controls to be, monopoly capital to emerge within the nation-state framework. The classic case here would be the Detroit auto companies in the 1950s and 1960s. Three companies, oligopoly, they could just price fix as they wanted. Very low competition. It was during those years that Baran and Sweezy came up with the theory of monopoly capital, which made a lot of sense at that time. French Communist Party laid out a whole kind of theory of state monopoly capitalism at that time. And it made a lot of sense, and Baran and Sweezy were kind of saying this will lead to stagnation. And it did. So the blockage there was also there was too much monopoly in the system. So part of what happened in the 1980s is you started to introduce competition. So the Detroit auto companies, what happened to them? Well, they suddenly got hit with German competition and Japanese competition and later on sort of Korean competition. And it became much, much more competitive. The result of all of this was that innovation could go forward apace. And after all of that, of course, then there was the political assault. You know, if none of that worked, you invented people like Reagan and Thatcher and Pinochet and people like that to go and sock it to labor, you know, just politically. So I would argue that this was a serious blockage point in the late 1960s, 1970s, but by middle of the 1980s, it had essentially been relieved. Capital had access to the global labor force. It could go wherever it wanted. And it could discipline labor. And the result of that has been that the share of wages in national income in all of the OECD countries has gone down. The share of wages in national income even in China has gone down. So wages become less and less and less a significant part of the economic dynamic because there is wage repression going on. Wage repression, which is pulling the wage rate down. Real wages haven't budged very much since the 1970s. They've gone up here and gone down there, you know, but they've been pretty stagnant since the 1970s onwards. And it comes out from the way capital got around that particular barrier. So that's the second. The third is barriers in the means of production. And there's a complicated story, and I'm going to leave out half of it, you know, how you find enough means of production, of how the parts get into the automobile, all that kind of stuff, and focus on the one that lies behind it, which is, are there limits in nature? Are there natural limits in terms of raw material resource supplies? Now, capital has a very long history here, which is very interesting to go back and look at, which is every time it's faced with a barrier in this dimension, and it has been at various times in the past, it innovates and gets past it. It innovates in all kinds of ways, and has been very sophisticated in dealing with the natural limits. Now, having said that, doesn't mean because it's done that in the past, it can do it again. But clearly, at this particular point, many people would start to articulate the idea that there is a limit in nature which we are approaching. But here I would also mention something. The last time there was a big crisis in the 1970s, this limits in nature also was suddenly brought into the picture. Very big time. This is the time of limits to growth and all the rest of it. And this is when, you know, Barry Commoner and all of those were, you know, great, and the Sierra Club really got going. And the interesting thing about this is every time there's a crisis, there is a segment of the bourgeoisie that wants to say it has nothing whatsoever to do with capital. It has to do with natural limits, i.e., you know, the Malthusian story is pulled out, you know. And Marx is, of course, fiercely opposed to that, and I'm fiercely opposed to that, because he said, basically, Marx said of Ricardo, when he hits a crisis, he takes refuge in organic chemistry. But this does not mean there are not serious problems and serious adjustments that need to be made in this domain, and those serious adjustments can mean radical reconfiguration. So you can get an environmental crisis of a certain sort, which is then exited from. So it is not as if this is not a source of serious problems. Historically, it's always been there, and it's been very significant. Next comes the point of production, and there are two elements here. One is the whole kind of question of technological and organizational form, which determines how much labor you need and what the means of production are and all the rest of it. So technological and organizational form become very, very significant. And here, too, the whole history of innovation in technological and organizational forms comes into the picture. And two things, again, can happen. You can get stagnant situation of technological and organizational forms, which can act as a barrier to further accumulation. In other words, zero gains in productivity can often create the stagnation, which becomes a very serious barrier to the continuity of this process. The other problem which comes here is that excessive technological change becomes a problem. In part because the actual utilization of your equipment, you need to amortize it before the new equipment comes in. And part of the problem right now is you're getting new technologies coming in so fast that you can't really amortize the old, and so you can get all kinds of devaluations going on, and that can sometimes cause massive sorts of problems. But here, too, also, technologies is not simply about machinery, it's also organizational form. A lot of the gains in productivity that have come over the last 30 years have been in organizational forms. Consider the Japanese auto industry, just-in-time production systems. Actually, where does Walmart's profit come from if it's not from organizational form? So that organizational forms are just as important in all of this as the hardware of technologies. The other thing that can happen is that for fetishistic reasons, capitalists often emphasize labor-saving technologies. And if you're kicking labor out of production, and if labor is going to be the source of your surplus value, then you've got a real kind of serious contradiction there. And there are many people who call this the falling rate of profit theory, if you like, which is generated out of the dynamic of technological change, which is far too much focused on what, if you like, labor-saving innovations. So the technological issue is a big one. Also in production, there is the fifth point, which is the labor process point. Discipline on the shop floor, put very simply. Discipline on the shop floor was a disaster in the end of the 1960s, early 1970s. In places like Britain, we had a shop stewards movement that was really bolshy. In Italy, you had, you know, the councils and the factory councils and all the rest of it. in this country, people were kind of prepared to lay down tools and all this kind of stuff. So shop floor discipline is a real problem. And there are kind of theories that really talk about this as being one of the big issues. For instance, if you read the autonomistas, they will talk about this all of the time as being the center, and that therefore this is where crises can come from, and this is where social change can come from, out of the labor process. So there's a labor process problem here. And finally, there is the whole kind of question of this step from the new commodity. Now notice, the implication of this, that there is more money around at the end of the day than there was at the beginning of the day. And this means there's got to be some surplus of money outside of this that can be brought into it. Where does the surplus of money come from? Well, again, what Marx could do in his time is to kind of say, well, you know, there's a lot of surplus money out there held by the feudal classes. There is, if you like, the gold reserves of the feudal classes. And we can just, and you know, and historically this was very important. I mean, merchants just sold to, you know, and got the merchants in, got the feudal classes indebted and stole their property and all this kind of stuff. So the relationship between the feudal classes. Well, there's not much of that left around right now. I mean, there's a lot of it in the Catholic Church, which they'll probably have to give up to pay for the sins of their priests. But that's not going to be a big issue. The second way was identified at the end of the 19th century very strongly by and into the early 20th century by Rosa Luxemburg, kind of saying there's something outside of the system. You can raid some non-capitalist world out there. You can sell to them. And the obvious example of this would be that there was a lot of silver in China. So you got the Indians to grow opium, which the British then forced into China. And then the silver came out of China and came to India. And then the Indians paid for the textiles, which they could no longer make indigenously. They had to make it. They had to buy it from Manchester, and they could pay it with the silver that had come from China. I mean, these kinds of imperialist kind of ways in which you actually use the world as a market and in a very destructive kind of way. Now, again, there has been and there still is some of that sort of thing around going on, but there's not much of it left. I mean, you can't do that to China now, and you can't do that in many other parts of the world. So there's some of it's there. So you have a real problem as time goes on that more and more you have to find the extra money inside of the system. The extra demand has to come from inside of the system. If you can't find the extra demand, which is desire backed by money, then the whole thing comes to a stop and you get what is called an underconsumption crisis. And many people would interpret the 1930s as typically an underconsumption crisis, that there was not enough effective demand around, which is why Keynes came in with a theory of effective demand and said, well, the way you create effective demand is you use the state to debt finance and all the rest of it. That's what a Keynesian program is really all about. It's about creating effective demand and getting past this barrier that way. But what happens here is that actually, in a smooth situation, the only way in which you can really internalize this within the system is actually by using a certain tactic, which is that tomorrow's expansion mops up yesterday's surplus production. Now, this sounds peculiar, but actually, that is what happens. That you expanded, but then you took it in by the expansion. And that's, so there are two reasons, therefore, why this system is perpetually expansionary. If it did not expand, you'd have an effective demand problem. Really, you would have an effective demand problem. And therefore, it has to expand. And it has to expand at around a 3% compound rate of growth. That's what it's been doing since capital began. So the expansion of this system is absolutely essential to its survival. Capital cannot survive without that 3%. A crisis is defined as zero growth. Obama says we're going to get back to 3% growth in 2011. And if you go to 5% growth, or like the Chinese, you get 10% growth, fine. But there's a minimum here, which is the growth thing. But notice something here. If it's tomorrow's demand which is going to mop up today's surplus, then where's the money coming from? Well, it turns out money has to be used as a means of payment, which means the credit system comes back in. That is, the financial institutions have to create the money, and they do it all kinds of ways, by leveraging, for example, They create the money to actually allow this whole thing to go forward. And people would argue that this actually creates a very peculiar situation. The best way I can explain it is this. That at the beginning of this circuit, finance capital may lend money to developers to go build tract housing outside of San Diego. And then the developers say, who the hell am I going to sell this to? And the financiers say, don't worry, we're going to find you buyers simply by lending money to buy them. And so actually finance capital operates at both points in this thing, both in terms of the supply and the demand for housing. It is therefore not a clearing market, by definition. I mean, markets only clear when there's a very simple break between the suppliers and the demanders. But when the supply and demand is managed by the same institution, plainly it doesn't necessarily clear, and actually the dynamics of that can lead into the kind of speculative booms we've seen in housing and all the rest of it very easily. Furthermore, notice, in recent times what's been happening is that actually, since there's wage repression, workers have less and less money, real money, to spend on things. So how is the effective demand maintained of the working classes when actually they are suffering from wage repression? The answer is, give them credit cards. So actually, we've actually bridged a lot of this whole kind of period from 1970s onwards by increasing household debt. And increasing it at an astonishing rate, particularly in the housing market. I don't think you realize, but if you add up all of the debt of the United States, that is all of the federal debt, the state and you know, municipality debt, corporate debt, and personal household debt, if you add that all up, 40% of it is accounted for by mortgages, housing mortgages. Now, part of that also attaches, by the way, to the very simple fact that home ownership is seen as central to the American dream, and we start to get some particularities coming in here, so that about 69% of the population of the United States, they're homeowners, or they were until recently. In Switzerland, it's only 22%. In other words, the boom which you've got in all of this arises out of a particular sort of situation of that kind, and increasingly, as you got towards the end of the 1990s, what you see is that actually the working class population that had the money was increasingly absorbed into the system, and this tremendous pressure starts to be exerted on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of the other institutions to start to find another class of homeowners. And that's where the subprime comes in. Therefore, you're keeping the whole system going in this kind of way. So this is, if you like, part of the dynamics of this system. I've argued a couple of things about it which are very important. One is, the continuity of this system is absolutely essential. If it stops for any reason, then the whole body politic of capitalism dies. It's analogous to blood flow in the human body. If it stops flowing, it's gone. I always remember, I came here just about 3 weeks before 9/11. Everything stopped. Until about 4 days later, Giuliani comes on television and says, for God's sake, get out your credit cards and start shopping. Go to Broadway, go to the restaurants, get out there. And then Bush is running around and actually got on a collective ad for the airline saying, start flying again. So if motion stops, the system stops. And we began to see little elements of that in this kind of volcanic eruption thing. Something stops, and so, you know, my God, the commercial pressures that come when the thing stops. I mean, it's just... So the continuity is absolutely essential. Furthermore, it turns out that the speed-up of the system starts to become very important. In part, turnover becomes significant, and it becomes particularly significant in the realm of consumption. You know, I'm still using my great-grandmother's forks at dinner. If capital only made things like that, what kind of market would they have? And actually, so more and more, they make things that either blow up or destroy themselves or something like that in 3 years, like computers, and are so fragile, or they innovate in such a way that, you know, if you sit there with a computer that's 4 years old, everybody looks at you somehow or other. Oh, you poor fella, you know, it's not, you haven't got that. It's not fast enough, is it? And it's iPads and new, you know. So you're looking for faster and faster turnovers, which also, by the way, explains something else about the dynamic of the last 30 years, that you want more and more modes of consumption which are instantaneous. And that means modes of consumption that are founded on spectacle. The spectacle, a large amount of money and assets go into building a spectacle, and the spectacle happens and bang, it's gone. So you wait for the next spectacle 2 days later. So we come into the spectacle economy. But I like very much, think about this, think about opening ceremonies of Olympic Games. They were quiet little things sort of about, you know, 40 years ago, and then they got more and more spectacular as time goes on. But then somebody has to pay for them, and there's no city that's ever had Olympic Games that hasn't come out of it. I think only one ever came out of it with a profit. They almost all made losses. And isn't it interesting, by the way, that Greece held the Olympic Games about, you know, what was it, 5 years ago, whatever it was. So the turnover of all of this starts to become significant. So the speed, access, turnover becomes very, very significant. Okay, that's part two. Part three. What I wanted to do and did in the what I wanted to do in the book was to start to talk about what seemed to me significant about Marx's theory of evolution. Those who've been in my Capital class, you have to forgive me. I'm going to talk about that again, which is the famous footnote that I didn't notice in Marx about the first 10 years of teaching it. Then it became more and more significant, and now it's become pretty foundational. Marx's theory of social change, what is it about? According to the footnote and according to the actual dynamics of what goes on in the chapter on industry and machinery and industry, Marx actually sets out a system like this. There are moments in the social process. There is a technological, understood as both a technological and organization moment. There is a question, a relation to nature moment. There is a social relations moment. There is a production in the narrow sense of production moment. There is a daily life moment and reproduction. A social life moment, if you like. There is mental conceptions of the world. And finally, there are institutional arrangements. All of these elements are seen as moments within the social process. And they're seen in much the same way I mentioned about, you know, production, distribution. They're seen as dialectically related to each other. When you reconstruct, starting with the chapter on machinery and modern industry, when you start to reconstruct Marx's theory of transformation from feudalism to capitalism, you would see that it rests on a transformation of all of those elements. Technologies have to change. Technologies and organizational forms have to change. The relation to nature changes dramatically. So do the social relations, and so do the production systems, and so does daily life, and so do mental conceptions and institutional arrangements. And these are dialectically integrated with each other and in motion. The revolution that occurred in the transition from feudalism to capitalism was a movement across all of those elements. It was a co-evolution, a co-revolutionary movement. And I make the argument in the Enigma book that therefore we have to think about the transition from capitalism to communism in terms of a co-revolutionary movement. Not one of these, you can't get there by just changing one of these. You have to change all of them. Furthermore, capitalism has been a permanently revolutionary force. It is perpetually changing all of those elements. But they sometimes get at odds with each other. They don't necessarily, they all are autonomous in one sense, but also interwoven in another. And therefore, they can sometimes get blockages can arise in these terms too. So mental conceptions, for example, cannot just in themselves change the world, but you cannot change the world without changing mental conceptions. So here comes, if you like, a foundational argument, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to go into it in any much more detail, to say that we need to think about this as a co-evolutionary process. Marx does not use a language of causality. He uses a language of interaction and dialectical internal relations and all the rest of it. And that is, I think, significant for a number of very specific reasons. Now, what is interesting to me is how many social theories do we have around that goes to one of these and says everything is explained by this? Technological determinism. Now, Mr. Flat Earth Tom Friedman thinks, you know, in terms of technological determinism. And when somebody says, well, Marx is a technological determinist, which he's not, Tom Friedman said, well, I guess I'm a Marxist. The relation to nature determinism, Jared Diamond, Jesus Christ, awful stuff. But on the other hand, he makes a plausible argument, you know, and you can start with any one of these and make a plausible argument. Social relations. Well, okay, class struggle changes the world, you know. Feminist struggle changes the world. Anarchist struggle changes the world, you know. So you can, or ethnic struggles change the world, or anti-racism changes the world, or something. So, you know, just starting from that, you get all of those changes. The whole notion of production, the autonomistas say, again, this is the place you start the revolution, and that's where it starts, and that's, you know, it's on the shop floor and all the rest of it. Daily life. You get somebody like Paul Hawken who kind of says, daily life, there are a million and one struggles going on, this is going to change the world. And of course there are plenty of people who say mental conceptions, and others, the institutionalists, who kind of say the institutions, you do it that way. Marx is talking about a co-evolutionary theory. And if we're thinking about anti-capitalist transition, you have to think of, therefore, about a co-revolutionary strategy and all that's involved in that. Okay, that's section 3. Very briefly. Section 4. This is not so much Marx as it is me. And I'm going to call it the Snoopy problem. Now, when I was thinking of this, I thought, shall I actually try and put this up on the screen? But since I'm a firm believer that power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely, I decided I'd show you this. This is a Snoopy cartoon, okay? And it's about Snoopy writing his great novel. And he starts off like this. It was a dark and stormy night. There he is, sitting at his typewriter. Suddenly a shot ran out. And then it goes on. My plot is thickening. He obviously believes in thick description rather than... A door slammed. The maid screamed. Suddenly a pirate ship appeared on the horizon. While millions of people were starving, the king lived in luxury. Meanwhile, on a small farm in Kansas, a boy was growing up. And here comes the last thing, and it says, in part two, I'll tie all of this together. Okay, here's our version of it. Somewhere outside of Palermo, the Schneiders had lunch with a mafia boss. Further north in Italy, Blim commiserated with his informants on the impact of deindustrialization. Suddenly in Caracas, Coronel jumped as a revolutionary brigade rounded the corner. In a dingy room, catty corner from the Empire State Building, Robottom fulminated at the perfidy of Stuart Hall and Paul Gilroy. Close by, or no, in Romania, Verdery stared in astonishment as hectares disappeared. Meanwhile, in New York City, poor graduate students were sitting in their rooms trying to make sense of their first-year course. But never mind. At 4:15 on Fridays in the Anthro Colloquium, we will tie all of this together. Have we done so?
Yes.
Thank you. So, now... This cartoon had great significance to me for the following reasons. It came out around 1971, and for some reason or other, I just thought it actually was very significant. And I cut it out, and I stuck it, and it was always in front of me in my workspace. And I went away for one of my very rare sabbaticals in 1976, and when I came back, it disappeared. By the time I had left, it was any case getting kind of, you know, what happens to, it gets all crinkly and brown and all that kind of stuff. But it always seemed to me, you know, very, very significant. And then sometime in the 1980s, I was reading a novel by Italo Calvino called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. Now, this novel is, I think, extremely interesting. And he introduces it and says it this way. He says, long novels written today are perhaps a contradiction. The dimension of time has been shattered. We cannot live or think except in fragments of time, each of which goes off along its own trajectory and immediately disappears. We can rediscover the continuity of time only in the novels of that period when time no longer seemed stopped and did not yet seem to have exploded, a period that lasted no more than 100 years. Now, these were, of course, the years when all kinds of people were kind of saying, meta theory is out, you cannot tell macro stories, etc., the whole kind of beginnings of the postmodern kind of thing. And I didn't find it, but I found this really, really significant. Naturally, you'll find it cited in The Condition of Postmodernity. And so this cartoon and Calvino played a very significant role, because about two-thirds of the way through the novel, Calvino suddenly says, and I know he fell over when he said it, he says, you know, I have on my wall a poster of Snoopy. If on a winter's night, you know, it was a dark and stormy night. I thought, Jesus, you know, well, you know. But the point is that actually this notion that time has got broken, that time... And later on, when Derrida's writing about Spectres of Marx, he has this long kind of thing about, you know, Hamlet's soliloquy, you know, and time is out of joint, and all of that, you'd see. And I'm kind of saying, it's not only time that's out of joint, space is out of joint, time-space is out of joint. And Calvino's novel is about, how do you write a novel when conditions for writing a novel do not exist? And he found a way to do it. He felt compelled still to write a novel. I mean, all kinds of peculiar things happened in there. I mean, I probably got it wrong, but I had a feeling that one of the characters in it is actually on a balcony. He has binoculars, and he sees this woman down there reading a novel, and he's convinced she's reading a novel he hasn't yet written. Yeah. So he feels impelled to write it. So the impulsions, you know. So I was kind of thinking, well, how do you write macro theory when time is out of joint and space is out of joint, which was, of course, one of the major theories of Condition of Postmodernity, which is to say, you know, this is not a huge kind of shift of... I mean, there's an explanation for why the theoretical problems are emerging in the way they are. And that something is about the shifting valency of time and space, and that therefore we have to start to look at this very seriously. Now, I've been trying for much of my life to do that, and I feel a bit like Calvino, unable, as it were, to actually resolve the problem, but actually impelled to keep on doing it. And I'm not sure exactly yet how it works. But what I did in The Condition of Postmodernity, of course, was to talk about the spatio-temporality. What I tried to graft into Marx, and Marx has something on this, and I was trying to pull out as much as I could from him about changing spatio-temporalities. And I taught this wonderful course with Catherine down in Johns Hopkins on, you know, space, where she made me read all of this ethnographic literature about, you know, stuff. And I still got her notes, by the way. She has fantastic notes. So if you want a spare set of notes on how to teach a course on space and time, I'll lend you Catherine's. But so, and then after Condition of Postmodernity, I returned to this themes many times in Justice, Nature, and the Geography of Difference. I had another crack at it. I had another crack at it last summer in Cosmopolitanism and the Geographies of Freedom. Now, what I find odd is that, you know, you look at the books you've written. And when you write a book like, you know, I don't know, well, Condition of Postmodernity was special, but the other books, that, you know, everybody gets them. When I'm writing about this space-time stuff, people don't seem to get it, you know. They get like Don Robot, and they kind of say, well, it doesn't matter, does it? So,
So I mean, talk about trying to undermine a whole career. I mean, but I guess if he can do it to Stuart Hall, he can do it to me too, right? So anyway, so there's a, and this then turned up in the Enigma of Capital as follows. So there are two chapters in there where I try to actually go do this again. This time I tried to do it in a less formal fashion and tried to do it in a much looser fashion. Because the issue is this, when a factory opens up in southern China and factories close in Ohio, and then other factories sort of closing or opening up in the maquila zones and forests get cut down here and cut down there, how do we put it all together? And at this point, I would go back to both the generality and the particularities and the singularities, that you have to start to put all of those elements together in some way or other. Now, I'm sometimes depicted as a person who just simply lives at the realm of generality. I think that's a very unfair characterization, actually. I'm constantly going on about what's the meaning of place? What's the meaning of space relations? What's the meaning of environment? And in Cosmopolitanism book, I tried to put together what I would call a dialectical integration, to treat it as a totality, that space and space-time and place and environment are not separate categories. They are, as it were, part of a totality. And part of the way in which capital reproduces itself is through transformative activities in the nature of spatio-temporalities and transformative activities in terms of place building, and also transformative activities in the production of nature. And that we have to take account of all of those elements, because in part that creates a world which we are then confronted with when we look to transform it. I mean, the joking thing is, how do you make a socialist paradise out of the New Jersey Turnpike? And we have created a world which we are now confronted with, and to some degree it imprisons us. The degree to which we are able to change things has a lot to do with the solidity of that world we have created. And one of the ways in which crises unfolds is, of course, in crises of the built environment. And it's very interesting. This one started, had a very specific geographical locus. If you took out California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida, you wouldn't have had the crisis we've got. Yeah, things were going on elsewhere, but most of them could have been contained. And anyway, nobody cared about the fact you had a foreclosure crisis in inner city Cleveland. So, but look at what's now happening. One of the theses that comes out of this argument here about, you know, the flow of capital is that capital does not solve its crisis problems, it moves them around. You go from one blockage to another blockage. It also moves them around geographically. Who would have thought 6 months ago that we'd suddenly be looking at Greece as the epicenter of a potential crisis that could bring the whole thing down? By the way, I think we're looking at the wrong state. The big failed state in the world is California. And believe you me, there's a lot of trouble going on in California, and it's going to get far, far worse. And, of course, New York may be next in the line. Right, Louise?
Right.
Yes. So we have it on from on high, you know, that it's... Look at what happened. And I tried to describe this. Okay, there's this thing in housing markets, which is located in a very specific way, in a very specific place, because of the, you know, all of this stuff about home ownership and, you know, all of these particular institutional arrangements and all the particularities that surround it. And then Wall Street crashes, and suddenly, you know, municipalities in Norway suddenly run out of money because they had invested in some CDO that was worthless. And then all of a sudden, the export, you know, and by the way, there was an interesting kind of phase, another form of explanation of the crisis is to explain it in cultural terms. Well, I was in Germany last summer, and a lot of the discussion was this was an Anglo-Saxon event. It was specific to the Anglo-Saxon way of doing business. The Germans had nothing to do with it. And actually, I was also in Brazil, and the Brazilians were delighted it was going on initially. They kind of said, finally, you know, they're getting up there what we've experienced from IMF restructuring again and again and again and again. Ho, ho, they were laughing until it hit them. So the thing spreads, and it spreads by mysterious ways, all sorts of weird ways. I mean, when I was in Berlin, I found this little kind of thing called cross-border leasing, which I didn't know about. It turned out that actually the U.S. tax code was such as to give investors vast tax breaks on foreign investments, and in particular upon depreciation of. And in the 1990s, German municipalities, given the rise of neoliberalism, of having real trouble finding finance, and along came Goldman Sachs or somebody or other and said, look, well, here's a deal for you. You lease all of your equipment to these American investors, and then you lease it back. They will then get the tax break, and then they'll share the tax break with you. So in the 1990s, Berlin got about $90 million out of this deal. It turned out the American taxpayer via this was actually subsidizing German municipalities. Now, they closed that in 2004, but one of the things in the fine print of this was you had to have an adequate insurance on the value of your capital stock. Either that, or you had to put your, you know, you had to put your own money down as guarantee. And so Goldman Sachs and everyone, whoever it was, came along and said to them, I think actually it was J.P. Morgan, came along and said to them, well, okay, we've got a really, really good insurer for you. You have to be AAA rated, and it's Lehman Brothers, the Icelandic banks, and AIG. And they're solid as rock, so you insure with all of them and you'll be okay. So they insured with all of them, and then they went bust, and now J.P. Morgan is saying, hey, you've got to find a AAA insurer, which they can't find, or you've got to put a deposit down. In other words, you've got to put down something like $300 million. And, of course, the Berlin has not got it. So the court case is now beginning to rise about all of this kind of thing. Now, Berlin leased all of its transit stock. Leipzig leased almost everything in Leipzig. The waste disposal plant, the water system, the buses, the convention center, they leased everything. And so suddenly you find this huge kind of thing going on in Leipzig because of this. So these are the ways in which the thing spreads. And of course, the tremendous crash of the export markets, and the Germans kind of saying, oh, this is, you know, and the Germans kind of claim they have nothing to do with the formation of this crisis, but they benefited from the crazy consumerism that was going on in this country. If there had not been the crazy consumerism going on in this country, where would Germany have exported its products to? The crash of the export market showed them pretty fast how close they were connected. So here's the thing, that you cannot understand the dynamics of the crisis without understanding how it's moving around. It's moving now and has moved right now from the financial system, the banks, to sovereign debt and state debt of different countries. And when you ask why is it that Spain is in such a mess, has a lot to do with flows of capital coming from Northern Europe, Germany, Netherlands, and all the rest of it, which absolutely trashed the environment in southern Spain because everybody wants to go and sort of play around in sun, sex, and sand and all of that. So the whole of southern Spain is an absolutely urban disaster. Empty condominiums sitting there right now. The tax base collapses for the Spanish government, and so they were doing perfectly fine until all of this happened. And a lot of it has to do with the cavalier forms of Northern European investment, which destroyed the environment there and in the Balearics and all the rest of it. So my point here is the Snoopy story is something which is very important to understand, but it's very, very hard to track. And I'm not sure at all how to do it, except to kind of give a sense of it. So one of the things I tried to do in the book is to give some sense of this and to say to people, look, just watch how it's moved around. And by the way, if you look backwards, since 1973, you look how crises have formed and moved. The Mexico debt crisis, 1982. How did it move and where did it go to? And then you get the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s in this country. Then you get sort of long-term capital management. Then you get the sort of property-led crisis at the end of around 1990 in the Nordic countries and also in Japan. And the Japanese system crashes, by the way, on land value, excess land value stuff. And then, of course, it moves to East and Southeast Asia. So suddenly you see the things moving around. And after East and Southeast Asia crashes, Russia goes bankrupt, then Brazil goes under, and then Argentina goes under. In other words, instead of seeing these things as isolated things like this, you have to see the continuity of them and the way they're moving around. And the tendency we have is to say, since it hasn't hit me, it's their problem. Particularly if they happen to be a different race or a different ethnicity or a different kind of, you know, culture to you. You know, I mean, it becomes very easy to say, well, that's their fault. You know, the Latvians, obviously, the Icelandics, well, you know. So this is, if you like them. Now, Marx didn't have a very good way of handling this. I spent much of my life trying to figure it out. But although I can't figure it out, as it were, as a simple set of generality principles, I can sort of say something about the dynamics of it and what those dynamics are doing, and how it's vitally important to look at the transfer of these impulses. And it was so interesting to see the way in which Greece was characterized last week by some of the financiers. They said it's like an Ebola virus. It's contagion. And actually, if you look in financial markets, the one word you see again and again mentioned is contagion, the threat of contagion. We've got to contain it. The contagion of East and Southeast Asia, keep it there, keep it there, keep it there. And so the contagion effect is very, very important to look at. And this is the kind of world we are living in. And, of course, what nation states try to do is to shift the contagion to somebody else. The only trouble is it comes back and hits you. I mean, if Germany does not participate in bailing out Greece, if Greece goes bankrupt, then the banks that lent to Greece are going to go bankrupt. And where are they located? Germany and France. So Germany either bails out the Greeks or it bails out banks in Germany, you know, whichever it does. And so, you know, and the reason we got the IMF way back was because, you know, the IMF came back into play in 1982 in the Mexican debt crisis was because Mexico was bankrupt, and if it was going bankrupt, if they had gone bankrupt, the New York investment banks would have been destroyed. And in order to rescue the New York investment banks, the IMF went in along with the Treasury and did structural adjustment, said pay off the banks in New York City and reduce your standard of living by 25%, which is what a typical structural adjustment program does. So these are, if you like, the dynamics. And it's the Snoopy problem that bothers me most of all. I kind of got a lot of, most of the rest of it I think I've got figured out. But as you can see by the examples I'm giving, this is the way in which I actually wrote the Enigma book, very much along these lines, using all of these elements and saying, look, you have to, in a way, I try to invoke all of them. There's a whole chapter on section 2 and also on section 3 and also about the Snoopy problem. And the general framework is set up in very much in these terms. So that's, if you like, the methodological foundations, but if you ask me what they are next year, they probably have changed. Which they should, because the dialectic of it is always in motion. So let me leave it there. Thanks very much. As usual, we can have some questions, I suppose.
What's the footnote?
Footnote? It's the fourth footnote in chapter 15 of volume 1 of Capital. It's the lines which begin, technology discloses. The first part of the footnote is about his relationship to Darwin and how he sees him. This is the separation, if you like, between the universality, but also with some critical commentary about the relationship, his sense that how that universality cannot be understood either outside of the dialect. Yeah.
I was trying to think about what in your new book, the last chapter you have titled What is to be Done, which I thought would be very interesting. How I read it as a reference to an older book titled What is to be Done.
Yep.
I don't know if that's true or not. But
No, what are you talking about?
I guess my question would be is my guess is you're not asking all us young grad students to replicate another David Harvey. By saying what is to be done, you're asking that the solution to the crisis that people are facing lies somewhere else from the institutional framework of grad school, especially what it's become the last 30 or 40 years, where one way I've thought about it, it's predominantly the left wing of capitalist society. It's also plays other roles than being the left wing of capitalist society, but it institutionalizes the left in a very powerful way. Within the framework of capital. And so your reference to what is to be done, I thought, was really interesting. So what are you trying to say, if you could expand on that?
Well, the original title of the chapter was What is to be Done and Who is Going to Do It Where? And actually, the original title was Who the Hell is Going to Do It Where? But I don't know, publishers sort of objected to that. They thought it was a bit too long. So it is what is to be done and who is going to do it. What I wanted to do was to recognize that the thinking of the left has not progressed anywhere near as much as it should. I think that there is therefore a lack of vision of an alternative. But at the same time, you just can't articulate a vision without the idea of who might latch onto that vision. And actually, if you look at all of the social movements around, locally the Right to the City, or if you're in Brazil, the MST, or there are a lot of organizations around who are articulating to some degree an alternative vision. And it seemed to me it was therefore very important to sort of try to set up a discussion and a debate. I mean, I regard this book as an invitation to a debate and a discussion on some foundational principles which exist, which recognize the generality with which we're faced. And in particular, the real problems that are arising over maintaining a 3% compound rate of growth forever. I mean, I was on with two journalists from The Guardian last week on one of their podcasts. And at some point, they were giving me a rough time because, you Marxists, you think you understand things. And I said, so I just said to them, can either of you imagine a world in which you get 3% compound growth forever? And they both stared at me, and one of them said, I never think about that sort of thing. And I say, actually, you should be thinking about that kind of thing because, and I, the data I was quoting, I said, 3% compound growth in 1970 meant you had to find something like $0.4 trillion of new investment. Now it means $1.5 trillion of new profitable investment. In 20 years' time, you're going to have to find $3 trillion of profitable investment. Part of the argument looking back is that it was this difficulty since 1970s, and one of the reasons we have investment in assets rather than in making things is because nobody could find a profitable place to put it. And actually, profit rates in making things were relatively low. And if you get 2% for investing in making things, and you can make $3 billion in 1 year, like these five hedge fund guys made last year by simply betting on the crash of something, then why would a savvy investor invest in real things as opposed to... So what we've seen is asset bubbles after asset bubbles. So I think there's a lot of evidence I tried to assemble there to say that this stuff is you were at an inflection point where 3% compound growth from now on is going to be more and more problematic. And I use the physical example of, when capitalism was simply constituted by what was going on in Manchester, Birmingham, and a few other hot spots in 1750, 3% compound growth, what's the problem? 3% compound growth, when we're looking at everything that's going on in China these days and everything, and much of what's going on in South Asia and all of what's going on in North America and Europe and Japan, and you kind of look at it and say, physically, this is beginning to look... And of course, environmentally, there are all sorts of problems emerging there. So, I think that as I said, one of the things is to start to think clearly about alternatives. One of the things that's very important to me is that in thinking about alternatives, you should understand the nature of the system in which we live. Which is why I object not so much to the way in which all of the explanations of the crisis have been, at these levels and not at the level of the generality. And like I say, I don't think those explanations are wrong at all. But when they are isolated and treated as if they are the only story in town, then you've got real difficulties, I think, of interpretation. So I wanted to shift the terrain of debate back into this direction. It's a political intervention. We'll see if it works. My impression is it'll have some impact. how much, I don't know. But it's, but then the question arises is, what do we do in relationship to this? And who does it? I can't claim I'm deprived and dispossessed. I can claim that I'm alienated and discontented with what's going on around me. And I kind of said, well, imagine an alliance between the alienated and the discontented and the deprived and the dispossessed. And I was saying this at a lecture in the LSE this week, and one student said, I am alienated, discontented, deprived, and dispossessed. I said, well, what do you do? He said, I'm an adjunct. I said, well, you're the perfect revolutionary subject, so let's go, okay? So you know, some of you are ripe for that, right? Okay, I think there's a terrain of debate here, and what it seems to me, and I think one of the difficulties I have with the left has been a certain lack of imagination and also an inability to communicate. And I think we have to overcome that and get out of. I mean, when I make this argument about crisis, for example, the traditional Marxist left kind of says, oh, you're abandoning the falling rate of profit theory, aren't you? And I say, well, yes. Well, that's sacrosanct in a lot of people. And so, boy, do you get in trouble with that one. And if I kind of say, you know, it's an effective demand problem, they say, ah, oh, you're an under-consumptionist, aren't you? You know, so you kind of go, well, yeah, well, but at this time, that's the nature of the problem, you know, and that's where it is. So, and how capital responds to that. So it has to be a movement of some kind, and I think it's, you know, books like this come out of a certain frustration with the levels of discourse and what's being said, where and how, and it's looking for a way to formulate it and have an invitation to a discussion. I have no idea who might take this up and where they might take it up and how they might take it up. It just, you know, how would I know that? But I think that when you look at the number of social movements and the variety of social movements around the world, and obviously the searching to be live in a world that's something other than the one we have constructed, then you kind of say there are chances here. And I'm very tired of the left kind of saying, well, in a crisis, everybody goes right. I mean, I've heard several people on the left say that. And I said, well, that only happens if you don't do something. I mean, we have to organize right now around a left program of some kind. And I was trying to articulate some of that those ideas at the end there. Around what do we do about you know, the technologies and mental conceptions and so on. By the way, there is no serious social problem in the world. If you want to solve global warming, look at the answers that are given. Technology. You say, well, what about changing daily life? Isn't that important? Wouldn't you get far further by changing daily life? And what about social relations? And what about, you know, I mean, in other words, this idea that somehow or other you can solve a problem without actually invoking all of those elements, all of those moments in the social process. So I want to say that a political movement has to be, I think, aware of that, even when it's got a limited objective, like, you know, dealing with climate change. Yeah.
But it seems to me that when I listen to this just incredible array of arguments that you put together, I feel political paralysis setting in, because where do you intervene at this, when basically everything is connected to everything? Is each intervention there going to have some kind of clear payoff? Or do we need a theory about which of those things are the points of greatest efficacy in some kind of political attack?
I think, you know, you have to think here in terms of alliances. I mean, I work primarily on mental conceptions in the world. And so that's the point where I'm, you know, I would try to intervene personally. But what I certainly would not say is that my interventions are going to change the whole world without being in alliance with people working in other points in that co-evolutionary process or co-revolutionary process. That is, I would want to be in alliance with, say, people in the social movements of some kind who are trying to change social relations. people who are trying to change daily life. I mean, in other words, this is where I think it's not as if there is a, when I argue, there's not one single point you can decide is the intervention point. There are multiple intervention points. I mean, I answer the question, where do you intervene? I can say you can intervene at any of those points, as long as you don't stay at that point, as long as there is a movement from that point to another point. In other words, what is the relationship between mental conceptions of the world and the invention of new technologies? And how is technological evolution actually perpetuating capitalism and fundamental to the perpetuation of capitalism? Are there ways to think of a technological trajectory which is distinctively away from the perpetuation of capitalism? And what would that technological trajectory look like? I mean, you look at a struggle over something like the internet, the struggles over the institutional background to it, the struggles over how it is being used. There are struggles which do spill over into daily life, and there are struggles of, you know, mental conception. So there are terrains of struggle which are there, which involve, therefore, an alliance of forces. And we have to think, therefore, not about, well, where is the intervention point, but think about the nature of the alliances that could be constructed in such a way as to move this thing around. Again, what was impressive to me about the chapter, when I'm reading the chapter on machinery and modern industry against the background of this footnote, is you see there are points where, for example, you see social relations are changing because capital is looking for a new technological foundation and it finds it in the factory and factory production, which has radical implications for social relations. So you cannot change one without changing the other, and mental conceptions. Production has to be seen not as an art, as it was in the late feudal period, and has to be seen in terms of science and technology. Nature has to be interpreted not as something alive and having intrinsic value, but as something dead and something that can be given value by human activity. In other words, all of these conceptions have to change. And what you see Marx doing is to say, well, there was a long process whereby this came into being. And it wasn't as if one of those moments was guiding the whole thing, not at all. And now you either kind of say, all right, well, we just have to wait for this to happen organically in some way or other, or you say, well, when we're conscious of this, and it was, after all, Marx's argument, if we become conscious of how social and political change can occur, then we are in a position to actually try to work on it. But this world here, the conjunctural and accidental, is full of accidents, and we never know. Unintended consequences, we never know. So I don't think, it doesn't induce paralysis at all. It says, well, I'm going to go for what I can do, but I'm going to try and do it in such a way that it will be in alliance with many other forces which are developing in all of these other arenas, including those who are kind of arguing for a radical reconfiguration of daily life. For instance, the solidarity economies, the autonomist trend, and some of the anarchists and so on. I've given up kind of saying, well, they're anarchists and I'm communist. It doesn't make any sense. So you're looking to change the world, and how do you do it? I can't change it. I can just work on one part of changing it and see how I can be in alliance with others who are.
It's 6 o'clock, but we might take an LA time or stretch time a bit, and we can take maybe 2 or 3 questions, and maybe can ask this Michael.
David. The mention today of the debt crisis of Greece is another serious domino. And your notion of the assumption, essentially, of private debt being socialized at extraordinary rates, so that states are taking on all the social debt, essentially, to keep the ship afloat. It seems to be, I want to ask the question, this seems to me to be an extremely sensitive moment because it invokes clack, in the old sense, it invokes direct conflict over the state, distribution of the surplus, the consensus and legitimation of the state. It's by force in a certain sense. And you see the symptoms all over the place. The resistance is either to, eliminating the state guarantee and socializing private debt in Greece, or the resistance here or in Germany or in other places to the assumption of that private debt and its socialization. I mean, we've got a lot of conflict occurring over the space, and this particular point, I find it pretty significant. How do you read it?
No, I agree entirely. I mean, I think almost anybody would want to know when, you know, suddenly the Federal Reserve pumps in so many $ trillions into the economy. Where the hell did that come from? And where's it going to, you know? And what forms of real surplus production are going to, in the end, pay for it, you know? And who's going to do it, under what conditions? But we know roughly what it all means, I think, by just looking at a typical structural adjustment program. What happened to Mexico, just start with what happened to Mexico in 1982 or what happened to New York City in 1975. You know, we're going to go through that big time. And actually, there's an interesting analogy. In 1975, New York City had one of the biggest public budgets in the world. California now has one of the biggest public budgets in the world. And you see what's happening in California. You know, you're absorbing the debt, and you're wrecking the University of California system. You're wrecking the educational system. I mean, last time I was out there, I was down on the beach, and there's a bathhouse down there, but everybody was furloughed, so had to go piss in the sea. I mean, it was kind of, this is what's going on in California. I mean, this is a moment where, but again, one of the problems here is the mental conceptions with which people approach the nature of the problems. And it would be my observation that in a crisis, there's a typical tendency to put your head down and hope it goes away. When it doesn't go away, there's then the question of where did that come from? And there are some preliminary surveys that suggest that many people who've lost their homes, when you ask them what the problem was, they blame themselves. And they cannot see it in systemic terms. It's not a systemic problem. And part of what I'm trying to write here is write something which is a systemic explanation, so that maybe some people who've lost their homes can say, oh, well, I see. Yeah, no, I see why this system, where it came from, and what we can do about it. Now, resistance. I mean, again, if you look back, the stock market crash occurred in 1929, and it took to about 1933 before the social movements got into such a fierce, so there's usually a time lag because the legitimation breaks down, or the old system breaks down, and it's perfectly clear that that legitimation breaks down, and many people will go to the right, but I think one of the difficulties right now is we don't have an active left or an active enough left to sort of pull it in the other direction, although I think that's an unfair characterization because, I mean, it was so fascinating. I mean, the Tea Party have a meeting with about 200 people, and it's all over Fox News as if it's some big event, and they put the cameras in such a way that you think there are millions, and it turns out there's hardly anybody there. And there was a demonstration on Wall Street yesterday, which was really big, and it's not even reported pretty much anywhere in the media, as far as I can tell. So there are these sorts of issues which are arising too, which is an attempt to demoralize the left. And you'll find that also in Britain, where, of course, they have an election coming up, so nobody wants to rock any boat at all about anything, even though whoever comes in there is going to have to deal with their sovereign debt, because after you've dealt with the pigs, Britain is next in line, almost certainly, if this is an Ebola virus-type thing. There is a contagion effect. So, yeah, I think this is... But again, historically, what's interesting to me is how a crisis gets shifted around. And I'm trying to keep tabs a little bit about what's going on in China. I mean, the Chinese have got out of the crisis by a huge kind of Keynesian program, but also a huge speculative binge, I mean, particularly in Shanghai. Property prices in Shanghai doubled last year. And in fact, in terms of non-earning assets, the banks are full of, you know, got non-earning assets on their hand because they're fueling that speculation. Now, what are the odds of a crash in China? Because China's in training. I mean, the reason Australia's doing well is because it's supplying all the raw materials to China. Latin American trade is increased tenfold in the last 10 years with China. So China's having an immense impact in drawing some parts of the world out of the difficulty. If China crashes, what will happen then? But the way the Chinese are getting out of it, since they can't get out of it through the export markets, I mean, they are getting out of it a little bit that way, they have to do it internally. And since they've had wage repression down and down, they've either got to bring wages up, a typical Keynesian program, or they've got to have a massive kind of investment strategy, which they've got. So, again, the responses differ a lot to the crisis, depending upon where you are. And, again, this is the Snoopy problem of who responds where in what ways. The Germans responded very differently from the French, and the French from the British, and, you know, so the whole thing is kind of caught in this sort of dynamic. But underlying it is exactly the problem you're talking about, one that has to be, you know, at some point or other, resolved in aggregate. In other words, the general character of the system has to take care of it. But how to do it through the particulars becomes really the big question. Seems like everybody wants to go for wine, so let's go for wine.